Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on The View from the End of Life. Carrie Egan has seen it many times. She's a hospice chaplain who brings comfort and attention and active listening to the bedsides of the dying. She writes, "We listen to the stories that people believe have shaped their lives. We listen to the stories people choose to tell and the meaning they make of those stories." But what becomes clear in Egan's book is that as patients are telling the stories that change them, Egan is feeling a transformation too. And as she joins us, I'd like you to think about this. Is there a story that meant a lot to someone in your family or circle of friends that was told at the end of a life? A story that might have been hard to tell, but that is deeply meaningful to you and your family. So maybe it is a story that a grandparent or an ancestor told at the end of a life, and it's something that you still share in your family, among your circle of friends. Think about that this morning. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I know it's a little bit of a short forum on Twitter to talk to me about this, but if you can shrink it into 140 characters, I'd sure be interested in hearing about it on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. Carrie Egan is a hospice chaplain and author of On Living, and she joins us today from New York. And Carrie, welcome. It's good to have you in the show.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
You know, you say something early on in the book that I think is a good way to frame what you do. You say it isn't the chaplain's role to do the soul searching for the patient. Rather, it's your role to give space and attention to that. And this is my opportunity to draw you out on that. What's the difference?
The difference between what? What do you mean the difference?
The difference between the chaplain's role doing the soul searching for the patient and the difference between being there to facilitate it for the patient. Do you understand that?
I do. Okay. Yeah. I don't think you can do the soul searching for someone else. I think someone needs to look at the things that have happened in their lives, and only they can decide what it means. And I think that when people try to tell you what it means, you inevitably get it wrong. I think that that meaning comes from within the person who experienced it. I think that you can offer guidance, you can ask them to tell you, you can explore it together. But ultimately, if you try to tell someone what their life stories mean, you will get it wrong, and they will always get it right.
See, that has to be, I mean, that kind of has to be tempting both for the person telling the story and for you, because they're searching for meaning, and it's a moment when time is short and this sense of wanting to have meaning is urgent. It must be tempting for you to hear a story that's maybe full of some pain and trauma and say, well, this is what I think that means for you. So how did you learn that you couldn't step in and do that?
Well, you learn because when you try it, it's wrong. You learn by messing up. But I think it's a really natural impulse. I think it's really natural for people. I think that's why you hear a lot of cliches that people say to someone who's grieving, you know, God never gives you more than you can handle. Mm. That's not true. Sometimes people have more than they can handle. Sometimes people fall into really deep depression. Sometimes people, you know, end up abusing substances to try to deal with the things in their lives. Sometimes people commit suicide. I mean, to say to someone, God never gives you more than you can handle, it doesn't help. It doesn't help you handle what you're going through. It just tells you, you should be stronger. Why aren't you stronger? When people say, you know, God always has a plan, that can be really hurtful too, because you're implying that God's plan is to do really awful things to you. And so you might think God always has a plan, but to the person who's suffering right now, that's not necessarily comforting. In fact, it can be really hurtful. And I think as a chaplain, when you sit and you listen to people tell their stories, and they will sometimes tell you what other people have said to them. Mm-hmm. And it hurts. And so you learn it by making the mistake yourself as a chaplain, and you learn it by hearing people tell you what it feels like when others have tried to do it for them, when others have told them what something means.
Carrie, what do you do with bitterness? I mean, because I'd imagine as a chaplain, you don't want someone whose bedside you're at, someone you've come to care about, to spend final days or hours or however long it is in bitterness, because that's corrosive. But what do you do with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, if someone is really bitter, you need to sit with them in that bitterness. You need to explore the bitterness. You need to find out what is the cause of it. Why do you have so much pain? Why are you so bitter? What is the source of that? To try to shut down the bitterness, to try to go in and sort of cheer someone up. Listen, sometimes it's nice to be cheered up. I like to be cheered up sometimes. But that's not really the role of the chaplain. The role of the chaplain is to help someone understand what is the source of this anger, this bitterness, this sadness. And is there some way to look at it, hold it up to the light, and maybe transform it, maybe let it go? And, you know, sometimes people don't. Sometimes people don't have the time, they don't have the tools to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sad, but that's okay. You know, it's not my job to tell people how to feel at the end of their lives as a chaplain. It's my job to sit with them and say, okay, where are you right now? And is there anything I can do? Is there anything I can do to help you do this work of making or finding meaning at the end of your life? But it's certainly not to tell them not to feel their bitterness. It's to explore it and to say, why do you have this and not joy? Why do you have this and not hope? Do you even want joy and hope?
That makes a lot of sense.
That's the job of the chaplain.
Yeah. To the phones to Tamar in Minneapolis. Hi. Good morning, Tamar. How are you?
Hello?
Hi. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Good to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. I was listening to it, so I missed you.
That's all right.
Hi, this is Tamar Green.
Mm-hmm. Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little nervous, but I'm good.
So, Tamar, it sounds like you had an experience with your grandmother.
I did. So my grandmother, she passed away on September 24th, I guess it was 2011. And it was some of the most beautiful time of my entire life being with her for 10 days as she was dying. And I actually am a new acupuncturist, and it has just guided my life so much those days. I think what felt so sacred and so special to it was we accepted that she was dying. She didn't initially, but I think we did. And so it was like we stopped trying to do anything to fix, to get to the next step. And we put down all of the pieces. And what that allowed was just the space to be together and heal. And it felt like so much opened, maybe certain things that we could never necessarily label in words, but there was just a space for it all to be there. I loved what you said about meeting people exactly where they are and it not being your job to fix it, but just being there. And I felt that in that space was just being with her, being with each other, nothing else to do other than be there. And it felt like it really opened up a whole lifetime of healing and maybe things that had been held, but just allowing the space for it and the love of being together.
Yeah, Tamar, I think I'm really glad you called. And I think you've said something that I wanted to talk to Carrie Egan about, which is what Tamar said, Carrie, about accepting that her grandmother was dying and not being, you know, consumed or diverted by the idea that we can eke out another 4 days if we try this medical procedure. How do you handle that when families are going through that?
Well, you know, I've worked as a hospice chaplain, and I've worked in a hospital as a chaplain. And when families or patients sign up for hospice, they are saying, I'm choosing not to do any more treatment that I think or we hope will be curative. People in hospice can still get treatment they get a lot of treatment, actually, to treat pain, anxiety, any symptoms that come up. But they're no longer trying to cure whatever's happening. So they know on some level, I'm going to die. Usually the idea in hospice is 6 months or less. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's sunk in with people, but they on some level know it. In a hospital, it's different because a lot of times in a hospital, people are still looking to cure whatever disease process is making them terribly sick and could lead to them dying. So they're really different. They're really different approaches. So in hospice, people have acknowledged this is going to happen. It doesn't make it necessarily easier emotionally and spiritually for some people, but they know that that's the choice they've made. In a hospital, that's not necessarily the case.
You know, Carrie, I was talking about your book with a friend this morning, and I was saying that it surprised me how many people have carried guilt or shame or, you know, really corrosive regret from something that happened decades earlier to the moment when you find them, right, for however much time they have left.
Or even in their childhoods. I mean, it could be a whole lifetime.
Oh, my gosh, I know. Do you think this is about they are still regretting the way they behaved and this is one last chance to come to terms with it? Or is there a judgment day kind of dimension to this? What do you think that is?
Oh, I think it depends on the person. I think it depends on the person and what their beliefs are coming into the dying process. There are some, not as many as you might think, but there are some people for whom there is a lot of fear about a final judgment.
I see.
Absolutely. Mm. I would say, though, in my experience, for most people, that's not really what it's about. I think for most people, people who are dying, for the most part, they can't do much physically, so they're in there, they're thinking a lot, and they think back on their lives. It's just a natural part of the dying process, is to think back on your life and to figure out what it means. So those regrets, the shame that people carry around, I think it's really common. I think that most people you see walking down the street have that.
Yeah.
You know, most people you see, even people, you know, you look at some people and you think, wow, their life is just perfect. In my experience, it never has been. Not a single person hasn't had some great pain, some great struggle. And sometimes we put up really good facades to hide that, to put up this great public persona. But everybody has it. And I think when you realize that, it sort of changes how you go through the world. You can't help it. I remember when I was a student chaplain in Brooklyn, you know, after I graduated from Divinity School, walking down the street in Park Slope, and this just being overwhelmed. It was this moment of being utterly overwhelmed as I watched all these people walk by, looking in their faces and realizing every single one of them has a story. Every single one. And I don't know it, but it's there, and they carry it with them. And I think once you know that there are these hidden lives that people live, it can't help but I don't know. You feel your heart opening. That sounds so goofy, I know.
No, it doesn't.
You feel your heart sort of opening up. It can actually be a little overwhelming. It feels a little frightening almost. That moment for me did.
I would imagine that understanding that is part of what gave you the courage to write about your own experience and some of the shame that you carry. Unnecessary shame. May I say that from having read
book?
But so let's explain what we're talking about. This happened when you were giving birth to your first child.
Yes. So he was very big. He's more than 10 pounds. And so I ended up having to have an emergency C-section.
Mm-hmm.
and I had an epidural. But somehow in the midst of this emergency C-section, this giant baby, there's a couple of theories doctors have floated around. You know, maybe in sort of pulling out this big giant baby, the epidural got loose. But somehow the epidural anesthesia stopped working. And so I felt everything. Abdominal surgery. You really don't want to feel abdominal surgery.
Gosh.
You really don't.
Right.
So they gave me, the anesthesiologist gave me a drug called ketamine, which people have said is sort of an unusual choice in that situation. Mm-hmm. And what ketamine does is it causes a psychotic break. It causes a dissociative break so that it's not like a real anesthesia, which sort of stops you from feeling. Instead, it severs the mind-body connection. So it's supposed to do that. It's supposed to sort of cause this psychosis, a delusion, whatever we call it. And then it's supposed to wear off. And in my case, it didn't. It didn't wear off. And you know when you hear about, you know, maybe you've heard people say, you know, he dropped acid once and he was tripping the rest of his life. That actually happens. That's not folklore. It's not an urban myth. That can happen. And it's called drug-induced psychotic disorder. Wow. And that's what I had. I had drug-induced psychotic disorder, and it wasn't picked up for a long time. And I kept telling people, you know, psychiatrists, like, there's something wrong with my mind. And I knew there was something wrong. I knew from the moment I woke up, like, holy cow, there's something really wrong with me. Yeah. But nobody believed me. Everyone kept saying, no, no, you're fine. The half-life of ketamine is 24 hours or 48 hours, whatever it was. So it didn't get picked up for, you know, about six and a half, 7 months. So I was just walking around with psychotic for all that time. Yeah, months.
I mean, the way you refer to
this. It's really terrifying. Terrifying. Tell people, like, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, the way you refer to this in the book is having lost your mind. And I think, you know, you obviously, you know that this was a situation that was so clearly beyond your control. But here's where some of the shame comes from, right? Because you just can't shed the idea that you were irresponsible to your new baby because you were in this situation.
Well, it was a lot of things. I mean, number one, there is the stigma in the U.S. about mental illness is enormous. It's incredible. It's enormous. So there's a lot of shame that just goes along with that. The experience of psychosis was really terrifying. You know, I've explained to people that, you know, for me, my experience, you know, postpartum depression is to sadness and anger, as postpartum psychosis is to sheer terror. It's terrifying. And so to have experienced that, and then the shame was on lots of different levels. For a long time, I really felt like if I had just sort of been stronger during that surgery, if I hadn't, you know, made faces, grimaced, showing that I was in pain, if I hadn't kicked my legs around, because of course the anesthesia wore off, so I'm kicking on an operating table, which is very dangerous. If I had just held really still and gutted it out while they cut me open through the abdomen, that this wouldn't have happened, you know. For a while I was thinking, you know, if I hadn't eaten so much when I was pregnant, then the baby, you know, he wouldn't have been 10 pounds and I wouldn't have needed a C-section in the first place. You know, you go through this list of things. What could I have done to have changed this? And every solution I came up with involved me messing up. And there's a lot of shame with that. And then there's just shame in knowing that, you know, I don't really remember what I said or did while I was psychotic. I do know I said and did some pretty crazy stuff. Because of the few sort of snippets I remember. You know, I remember once standing in the grocery store with, you know, my baby in his little bucket seat in the cart, and all of a sudden this manager of the grocery store came over and said, "Excuse me, ma'am, do you need some help?" And I said, No, I'm fine. I'm just here to get some milk." And I go off and I get the milk, and I went back out to the car, and it was 3 hours later. Gosh. So I think I was standing there. I was standing there for 3 hours. I'm not sure what I was doing. But there's something really embarrassing about that, about not remembering, not knowing what you did, knowing you were acting strange and odd. And yeah, I was ashamed. It was a lot of levels of it.
Carrie Egan is with us. If you've just joined the conversation, she's a hospice chaplain. We're talking about her new book, On Living. You can read about it on the thread, nprnews.org/thread. And as Carrie and I talk about her work and her own personal experience and how that informs the way she attends and she listens at the bedsides of dying friends and patients. I'm asking you whether she hears a lot of stories, and whether there's a story in your family and your experience that was told at the end of a life that has been really meaningful, has changed maybe your family or your circle of friends somehow. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Amanda on Twitter says, great topic. As I travel home for my grandma's funeral, I've gathered her stories, themes of love, perseverance, and strength. And to the phones to Mike in Miltona. And Mike, thanks so much for waiting. I know it was a few minutes. I appreciate you staying with us.
Oh, I love the story. That was so powerful. Yeah, thank you for letting me share this. I'm the oldest of six boys. My mom was from western Nebraska. And back about 70-some years ago, before she got married to my dad, she was got basically raped and impregnated. Mm-hmm. And she had a child. And she followed this child. She gave it away, knew the family she gave it to. And but recently, the child that she'd heard had died. And this was all a big secret. Even my dad, when he married her, he kept this secret.
Really?
And last year, my 92-year-old mother, who is now 92, she told us boys that we had another brother that we never knew about. And I think, and she was so relieved to get this off her chest, but she'd held it for over like 70 years, you know.
Gosh.
How she kept this secret. And it wasn't that she was afraid of dying. I think she just wanted to get this out and to tell us. And it was my brothers and I were just so proud of her. And
Mike, I appreciate the call. It actually reminds me of Gloria Carey from your book, your experience with her.
Yeah, I really loved her. She was one of my favorite patients ever. So, Mike, I'm so glad your mom told you. I'm so glad she found the strength to tell you about her other baby, and you know you had another brother. I'm so happy for you, really, really happy for you, and happy for your mom. Gloria is a woman who had a really similar story to your mother. She was raped also. Well, she didn't use that word. I should take that back. She did not use that word. But she got pregnant with her best friend's boyfriend. And she was not married, obviously. And she decided she had to give the baby up. And she gave the baby up. And then she came home from the unmarried mother's home. And she realized she had made this terrible mistake. And so she sold everything she had. She was about 20 years old at the time. And she sold her car. She sold her records. She sold her hair curlers. That was my favorite detail. And she went back because she had to pay the unwed mother's home for the baby. And so she went back, and with all the strength she had, she didn't think she could do it. But she took the baby back from the unwed mother's home. And then she never told her son. And so she considered this the greatest thing she had ever done, the most brave, the most powerful, the greatest act of love she had ever committed. But she was also really ashamed of it because she had been an unwed mother. And there was so much shame, so much shaming of women back then. Still, oh, my Lord, there's still, am I saying? There's still so much shaming of women. We're living in the midst of it, aren't we?
Right.
And she never told her son, and so that's what she wanted to work with me as a chaplain. She wanted to find the strength to be able to tell her son that she loved him so much that she had basically given up her whole life for him. It was really hard. It was really hard for her. So I don't know your mom, but I can appreciate, I can imagine how much strength that took. And I'm really glad she told you all. Really glad. And I'm really glad you told me that. Thank you.
You know,
one of the things you learn listening to people's stories, and the reason I tell my story in the book and all these others, is that you see how to do it. You see that other people can do it, and you can do it too.
You mean tell the story, or?
Do hard things. Yeah. Really tell the story. Do the things that you thought you couldn't do. Tell the stories you thought you couldn't tell. Recover from things you didn't think you could recover from. Find meaning in things that at the moment and maybe for years and years, are utterly meaningless. I mean, there are some losses in this life that just seem utterly meaningless, and some remain meaningless even when someone dies. And you have to be okay with that as a chaplain, that, you know, sometimes, you know, the loss of a child or just, you know, something horrific and people can't find meaning in it. And that's okay, too. You can be with those people in that really painful meaninglessness. But listening to stories like about Mike's mom, you know, that I hope that gives everybody who listens to that courage to think, wow, she did that. She lived a whole life following that baby and loving him from a distance, and how hard that is. Well, I wish she hadn't. I mean, she did what she had to do.
Right.
But then she found the courage. She found the courage to tell her other children, you know, how much she loved. Because that, to me, is an expression of love, to have given up a baby. I can't imagine doing that. That'd be really hard. To give up a baby, to know the family raising him from a distance, and to love your child from a distance. How hard that is. So I don't know. I feel like that gives me a lot of encouragement.
You know what else? What else I was thinking about with Gloria's story. One of the people that you worked with that you tell about in the book is, you know, how much societal and even her parents' shame was something mm-hmm. that she kind of loaded onto her own shoulders and carried around mm-hmm. for years. And I know that's not uncommon, but it made me think about the freeing ability. And why does it have to happen at the end of your life? Why can't you throw off some of that?
Well, it doesn't have to happen.
Well,
right? You can do it earlier.
It often does. Right.
You can do it earlier. I mean, but it takes work. And, you know, I have a busy life. I've got two kids. And, you know, life is busy. Life is really busy. And this kind of work is hard. It's emotionally, spiritually, it can be really hard to do meaning-making work. And it takes time. It takes effort. And, you know, sometimes you just don't do it. You just don't do it because you don't make the time. You don't have the time. There's nothing stopping people from doing it right now. And people do. People do meaning making as they go through their lives. There's no, you would fall apart. You would be a puddle of nothingness if you didn't have to, as every day goes on, okay, that didn't happen the way I thought it was. I have no idea what to make of this.
That's right.
I need to, like, really make some meaning out of this right now. Because otherwise you're just walking around in despair. And some people do walk around in despair, and that's not an easy way to live a life, but you don't have to. But it does take work. And so we do make meaning all through our lives. But some of these really big, hard things that take a lot of work, I don't know. People just, they don't do it until they're dying, maybe because when they're dying, they have more time. But you don't have to carry it around your whole life. You really don't. And I think in some selfish way, part of the reason I didn't think I was going to put my story in this book at all.
I wondered about that.
I was just going to have it be stories of my patients. And it was my editor. I have a very brilliant editor named Becky Salatan. And she was the one who said, well, your own story should be in there. And I think she would have liked more. I probably would have had none. But what I came to realize is my hope in including my story in that book is that by telling my story and sort of how I've made meaning of what happened to me, by listening to my patient's story, is that the reader can then say, oh, that's how you do it. I'm modeling it for the reader. You know, if she made sense of this crazy story, which we all have crazy stories, that's what I'm saying, every single person out there has got crazy stories. If she can make meaning of it, and this is how she did it, by listening to other people's stories, well, maybe I can listen to other people's stories, and I can learn from those people certain tools that you can use to make meaning of the really difficult, confusing things in my life.
Carrie, the other value of you putting your story in there was I expect you to be compassionate because you're a chaplain. That's a skill and a talent you clearly have. But I knew after reading that and what that was like for you to, as we've said, carry around some shame and guilt around that. I knew that you got this at a very visceral level. You weren't just tapping into your chaplain skills on this. You really understand this at a very deep level, what it's like to hear people talk about these stories that they've not wanted to say for a long time. So it told me as much about you as it did about your work. And that's valuable to the reader.
Yeah, it's really a little bit scary. I haven't really talked about having had, you know, whether you call it postpartum, so different psychiatrists have called it different things, postpartum psychosis or drug-induced psychotic disorder. I haven't really talked about it very much. So it's a little scary for me. But what I've come to realize is that a lot of women have reached out to me more than I expected who said, I was given ketamine during childbirth, wow. and no one believed me when
really?
I said, I'm going crazy. Yeah, three different women, which doesn't sound like a lot, except that I didn't think, you know, most people are like, well, no one uses ketamine anymore. Three different women said, nobody believed me. And then I've heard from lots of different women who had postpartum psychosis and said, I've never really told anybody because I'm so ashamed. And that wow. has given me strength. That has made me say, well, you know what?
<It's>, yeah.
Why not? Why not just be out there and be open with it?
It did.
Because no one really talks about it.
Right.
Except in the really tragic cases, you know, like Andrea Yates. And she was really demonized. She was really demonized. And she was so sick.
Let me take a call here from Erin in Minneapolis. Hi, Erin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So my story is more about a story that I share now to my friends and family from the experience that I had when my grandmother passed away. So when my grandmother was a mom, she had nine children, but she lost two of them when they were young children. Mm-hmm. It was her first and her fifth born. And then she went on to have grandchildren. I'm the fifth-born grandchild, and my oldest cousin is the firstborn, and we share the same birthdays as the first and fifth-born children who died. And when my grandmother passed away, you know, she had been in hospice for a little bit, and it seemed like she was kind of, like, hanging on and lingering. And my oldest cousin, they lived down in the southeast region of the country, and they had made a long drive up and got there basically on the day that she died. And it was me and the firstborn my oldest cousin, the firstborn. The two of us were in the room with her when she died. And it was almost, I told the person who answered the phone when I called in that it was almost as if all four of us were in the room. You know, it was sort of this really spiritual, like, just, I don't know, deep sort of thing. And I don't know if I realized it, the depth of it at the time, but reflecting on it since then, it's just been very interesting. And I felt very connected to those people that I didn't know, but even maybe more connected to my grandmother as well. Like, it was as if she finally felt comfortable enough to go, knowing that all of her family had been and visited her, even the ones from the South.
Right. So, Erin, did the family know about the deaths of these children of your grandparents, of your grandmother? I mean, this is something that was well known, I see.
Yeah. So it wasn't, you know, I think the scope of my story is a little bit different. Not so much stories that, you know, that stories of hurt or shame or something like that, that were maybe never told and then came to light at a time, you know, until a time like this. But rather
the comfort,
just that comfort and, I don't know, strange occurrence of how things happen that we shared the same birthdays and we were with her when she passed away.
I'm glad to have the call, Erin. Thank you. Carrie, what do you hear in that?
You know, I think, and I've said this before, if you talk to anybody who works in hospice, they will tell you that sort of story is not all that surprising. That things that seem really miraculous can happen. Not always, but often. That there is a sense of togetherness and wholeness and coincidence, strange coincidences. I had a spiritual director who once said to me, she would say, I have this really deep devotion to the Holy Spirit. And I finally said, what does that even mean? Like, you have a deep devotion to the Holy Spirit. What is that? I don't know what that means. And she thought about it and she said, well, I guess what other people would call coincidence, I would call that the Holy Spirit. Huh. And so I feel like you see that a lot. You see that a lot.
Carrie Egan's book is called On Living. You can read about it on the thread. Carrie, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you. And thank you to your callers who called in.
Wow. Great calls and good conversation. It is Thread Week next week. Lots of conversation about books, lots of content on the thread, lots of calls and recommendations from you. It's Thread Week. Read more about it on the thread.